You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
And what an equal part when they're clearly not equal is called what again, class?
Communism!
That's right.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today is Ed Song. And Ed, you told me this last time, but I'm supposed to introduce you as associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College. And what's your other title now?
No, that's my title.
Okay. You're like intern director, intern coordinator.
Oh, yeah, that's not so much a title. I mean, there is the grand czar of political thought, but, you know.
Okay, well, right. There's that, too. So, associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. How are things in Santa Barbara, Ed?
Lovely here on this eve of the 4th of July.
Right, which it will not be when this drops.
Yeah, so, Coyle and I are recording this just around the 4th of July. Our patriotism episode just dropped. Did you see that article about First Baptist Church in Dallas and their patriotic?
I've heard of it. I haven't read it yet. But we talked about that in our patriotism episode. I don't think either of us would be okay. I mean, it wasn't a church service. Like, it was in the Kennedy Center, right?
Oh, no. I think that was Sunday. That was a Sunday service.
I thought it was in the Kennedy Center instead of in Dallas. This shows you how much attention I paid to the story.
So a bunch of people, I saw this on Facebook from a bunch of friends, one of whom was Michael Farmer, one of the grand czars of the Christian Humanist Radio family.
The Politburo, we got to call him for this episode.
Yes, Comrade Farmer had put it on his Facebook page, and it was pretty great. I don't, you know, my big problem is I don't think there are enough flags.
Right.
In for a penny, in for a pound, baby.
Right.
If you love your country. And the big flag, like, you got to have, like, the 50-yard long flag. If you don't really love your, you're not, if you don't have the fifth, like, a flag that's at least 50 yards long, you don't really love your country.
I mean, those are kind of expensive, so maybe it was a budgeting issue. Like, maybe they couldn't quite swing it.
I don't know, man.
Well, speaking of loving your country, we're doing another episode on Marx. I don't know if that means that we love the country, so we're going to keep Marxism out, or we love the country, so we're going to try to take some good stuff from Marxism, although I suspect we might have different answers to that. Speaking of Marx, so we've done one on Marx already in our previous Marx episode. We talked about Marx himself, the thought that he works into to some of his major writings. We didn't get so much into the 20th century filling out of that thought or application of that thought, and we're going to try to dig into that a little bit today. Neither of us are intellectual historians or historians of the 20th century, but we're going to try to touch on at least some of that. Before we get there, we do have a little bit of listener feedback directly relevant to the Marx episode, starting with a message from Travis Phelps, who asks, what work or works do you recommend reading to fully understand Marx? Ed, do you have any thoughts? What would you say to read in order to fully understand Marx, that important adverb there?
Yeah, that's a tough question, in part just because the Marx corpus is so ridiculously, I mean, it's like a glorious overgrown garden that hasn't been tended to over a period of time, and there's so much that Marx wrote that was never published, notes and things like that, and then a lot of the really central stuff that was published are just such dense academic books. Like, I just don't know that anybody would really be benefited by sitting down and trying to read the Grundrisse or Kapital, you know, over the weekends. So everybody, I think every intelligent informed person should have read the Communist Manifesto, which is short and self-contained and sort of orderly, like a self-contained statement. In some ways, he says some really important things there about what communism is supposed to look like. He actually doesn't spend a ton of time thinking about and explaining what he imagines the communist state to look like. But the little that he does say is probably most coherently expressed in the Communist Manifesto. So certainly, if you haven't read the Communist Manifesto, I'd go run out and get it. It's a thin volume, and read that. You know, otherwise, one thought that crossed my mind was I myself get a lot out of reading biographies of people. There are tons and tons of biographies. I see that there is a relatively recent biography by Gareth Stedman Jones called Karl Marx, Greatness and Illusion. I've seen reviews on that. I myself haven't read it, but it is a mammoth tome on Marx that looks pretty interesting. And then, you know, equally I would say, again, because the Marx corpus is so hoary, getting like one of these introductory kind of textbooks that has excerpts and sometimes some commentary can be really valuable. So in preparation for this episode, I was sort of going through a few of my books. And what's his name? David McClellan has a few books that are like that, like an introductory book, as well as a book of, I think it's just called Karl Marx Selected Writings, which is this nice kind of blend of short biography and a little bit of commentary on some central ideas over the course of Marx's intellectual career. And then just to close, there's a highly esteemed political philosopher named Jerry Cohen, G.A. Cohen, who was an analytic Marxist political philosopher. He died a couple years ago. He was an extraordinarily brilliant philosopher. And among his books, he has a book that's not super long and is a little bit more accessible called, what is it called? Oh, Why Not Socialism? And that might be a kind of an interesting book, maybe a little bit less on Marx himself, but on socialism in general. So those are my quick thoughts. How about you, Coyle?
I'd agree with the Communist Manifesto, because that is what Marx intended people to pick up and read as an intro to communism. Das Kapital, it's what, like two volumes, and they're not short volumes. I mean, it's in that good German idealist school of just writing everything.
It's like over 1,000 pages, I think, isn't it?
I mean, yeah. I wouldn't necessarily start with that. I suppose if you want to fully understand Marx, that's the right place to go.
Yeah, but a lot of that is like very technical economic thought about surplus value and capital and stuff.
So I'm too big of a pansy. I find economics boring, and I can't bring myself to read that. Intellectual historian of the 20th century named Tony Jute, J-U-D-T, recommended reading a shorter work of Marx's called The 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. I'm probably butchering at least one of those words because I don't speak French. I did read that one. It's only about 100 pages. It's a little bit technical in that he digs into the weeds of one of the French revolutions, the one of like 1848 to 1851 or somewhere in there. It is interesting, and the guy who recommended it was right. It is sort of Marx's observations on a socialist revolution in progress, and why it doesn't work and what sorts of problems it's going to run into. But man, it is just full of French names that he provides no context for whatsoever. I think it might even be like his journalistic notes of the events. I mean, it's just not super accessible, even though it is the ideas that are underneath it are kind of interesting. I'd also second just picking up a good survey of really any good survey of political thought should have something on Marx in it. My go-to book, which might be out of print now, Halliwell and Porter's. Oh, and now I'm blanking on the title. It's their survey of political philosophy. It might even just be called political philosophy. We'll throw links to these up in the show notes. And then there's a short volume called Reconstructing the Classics by a guy named Portis has chapters on all of the major political philosophers. The bibliography for either of those books would be worth looking at, as well as the books themselves. So hopefully that's helpful. Thanks for messaging us, Travis. Hopefully we answered your question. If you read all of that stuff that we recommended, I think I can say you'll fully understand Marx. I don't know what else that might take all of your time for the next several years, but you know, at least you'll understand Marx. We also have a message from C. Derek Varn, who has appeared on the Sectarian Review, who claims to be the only Marxist that shows up on Christian Humanist shows. He says that we did a good job and a fair job talking about Marx, despite the horror story of the history of Marxism, which we're going to get into a little bit today. And then he asks whether or not democracy and capitalism necessarily go together. Does capitalism sort of force democracy? And asks for some response to that. Ed, what are your thoughts?
Oh, yeah. So I replied to Derek. And so I made that comment, I think, in passing, about that connection between capitalism and democracy. And actually, right after I uttered it, I thought to myself, you know what, Ed? You don't really believe that. Or at least, I was sort of like, I'm not sure if I believe that. But anyways, so that is certainly a complicated story, and so I partially retract what I said there. That's a complicated story. I don't know that I completely retract it, but that's complicated. I suppose I do... I'm sort of a two cheers for capitalism kind of a guy, insofar as I think there's a way in which socialist, like really hardcore socialist critics of capitalism, fail to give capitalism its due in the role that it's played in like reducing just tons of immiseration in human society. And I think I've used this example before, but in Jeffrey Sachs's book, The End of Poverty, there's a chart in the beginning of the book that's like a chart of estimated global GDP from like the time of Jesus to now. And basically for almost the whole of human history, and in fact, it might go back to like the earliest beginnings of human civilization in as much as we know it. But like, so going back 10,000 years... I mean, basically, the line is flat for 10,000 years, and at the very end, it sharply tips up, beginning in the 19th century with industrialization. And, like, industrialization has generated wealth and the increase in standards of living that has just led to the elimination of... I mean, basically, everybody for the whole of human history has been living in the kind of crushing poverty that's familiar when we look at, you know, the third world and the developing world. And that's basically only really ended for the majority of the global population because of industrialization. Now, with that said, you know, I worry that there are certain tendencies in capitalism that generate certain kinds of problems that need to be addressed. But, you know, then yeah. One of the things that we're going to be talking about today is the extent, I mean, Marx thought that capitalism was an important evolutionary step to the thing that comes after it. And you don't get to the thing that comes after it without going through capitalism and for capitalism to run its course, basically. So...
On that line, the wife and I are watching through the USA series Mr. Robot, which we're only a couple of episodes in, so, you know, don't spoil it for us if you've seen it. But... at least within the first couple of episodes, it is kind of a communist isn't the right word, kind of a libertarian anarchist conspiracy theories show, right, where the corporations are secretly controlling the world. And isn't it terrible that they're doing all of this awful stuff?
Sorry, that sounds like a good episode for Danny to talk about on his show.
Well, right. And I mean, as I'm watching it, my thought is, yeah, those evil corporations, what with their bringing, you know, food and clean water and jobs to these third world nations. So which isn't to say it's an unmixed blessing. Right. It isn't to say capitalism is automatically good. But I just, yeah. Which also isn't to say, to get back to the original question, not to say that capitalism automatically leads to democracy either. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I don't know how we got onto that.
Any case, we're grateful to Travis and Derek for the for the questions and the feedback. We really enjoy getting those, so keep them coming. Okay, so with that said, Coyle, why don't you kick us off and talk a little bit about the development of communism through the 20th century.
Yeah, so there are a number of places where communism gets picked up and run with in the 20th century. And again, neither of us are historians or intellectual historians of the 20th century, so we only can say some limited things about this. Obviously, the big two sort of international practical examples, the Soviet Union and Communist China, right? The People's Democratic Republic of China. And there, as a good conservative, I would say you see sort of the logical historical working out of the ideas that drive communism. If you are a consistent communist, you end with the gulag or the re-education camp. I think that's sort of built into the stream of utopianism that drives communism. We hinted at this in the last episode, but we didn't really get into the weeds of it. But I think. For all utopians, whether you are a utopian on the right or a utopian on the left, you have to begin with the idea that people are basically good. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to be a utopian. And then if somehow you can tap into that inner goodness, you can harness it and put it to work and build a society that will be perfect, you know, the Marxist communist state. The problem that you run into in the real world, of course, is that people aren't necessarily always good. And no matter what sort of systemic things you do, people are still going to do bad things, which could lead to someone rejecting communism. We see that in the writings of someone like Whitaker Chambers, right? The great 20th century classic Witness, where he had been a communist, converted to Catholicism, and started to see that the opposite of communism is a healthy doctrine of original sin. That's one possibility. The other possibility, if your utopian dreams are not being realized, is to decide that they're not being realized not because there's anything wrong with your utopian dreams, but because there are conspiracists out there who are working to thwart you. So if whatever program it is that you're trying to put in place doesn't work, well, it's because the bad guys are there stopping you. So they need to be re-educated, or they need to be thrown in prison, or they need to just be
executed. Sorry, I thought this was a Marx episode, not a Trump episode. What's
well, any of the great leftist totalitarians, it's going to apply to you. That's going to be sort of across the board, and I think we see that rhetoric certainly on all sides, and it's particularly increasingly in American politics, right? Why is it that Obamacare never really worked? Well, it's because those awful Republicans were out there stopping it. Why is it that we haven't gotten our Republican replacement for Obamacare? Well, it's because those liberals are out there stopping it. Again, there's that utopian stream and utopian strain in all of us, but the communists, particularly in the Soviet Union and in communist China, other communist nations, just sort of drive that to its logical conclusion, which ends with the extermination of the aristocrats, the capitalists, the opponents of the state, who, because they're the opponents of the state, they must be evil and have to be destroyed.
Can I?
You want more?
Sorry, can I just push back a little bit on that? About sure. So you're trying
to defend the communists.
Well, you're trying to suggest that they're. I'm not going to defend the communists. I'm going to defend Marx.
Okay.
A little bit. So your point there is that there's something necessary in the DNA of Marxist political thought that makes it tend towards violence in the gulag.
I mean, it doesn't. So I don't know that it necessarily tends toward that. That particular form of it, but it has to tend towards some equivalent. I guess maybe that there are different historical instantiations of it, right? The gulag, concentration camps, re-education camps, whatever you want to, you know, genocide. If you decide that it's racial rather than class based, but yeah, I think that's pretty clearly the direction it leans.
Well, yeah.
Because, again, of this utopian...
This is one of the areas in which it just gets complicated because Marx's corpus is so long and hoary. There's so many instances in which in these unpublished manuscripts or lecture notes, I think he's sort of testing out ideas And it's sometimes difficult to sort out more what is Marx's considered opinion, what's an idea he's just working through, or what's his mark, or what's considered opinion, but he's changed his mind on a subject. But one thing that's clear that, like, on the topic of revolution, it's clear that he's really critical of the use of terror for political purposes. And that comes out in some of his criticisms of the French Revolution. I mean, Marx certainly thought that revolution was coming. For Marx, that was as much a kind of a kind of quasi-scientific or historical analysis of what has happened in the past, as opposed to an enthusiastic kind of normative prediction about what was coming in the future. You know, kind of like Christian apocalyptics. You know, Marx always thought that revolution was just around the corner. And then when it got here, it was sort of like, well, now it's really just around the corner. And then when it didn't get there, then it was still like really just around the corner. And there's an extent to which Marx's optimism about the, you know, the nearness of the revolution evolves over the course of his intellectual career. And it's also clear that he thought that it didn't necessarily have to be violent, that there was a way in which it could go down. And he was sort of especially optimistic about the way that the revolution might happen in the United States, for example, in which he thought that it didn't necessarily need to be violent. So again, there's certainly an aspect in Marx's thought that thought that revolution was necessary and unavoidable. But I think that revolution didn't always necessarily mean a violent revolution. And there are ways in which he could imagine that the transition of power happening in peaceful ways.
Right, but the issue isn't so much the nature of the revolution, although, of course, that historically did end up being violent. The issue is, what do you do with people in society, either who refuse to go along with the state that's set up? Like, what vehicles? I'm just not familiar enough with Marx to know what his answer is.
Don't think there's any place in which he says that we should create gulags and lock people up. Part of it is, for Marx, there are a couple tricky things. Like, as we were saying earlier, Marx doesn't talk a lot about what communist society is going to look like. So we know that when the revolution happens, for a spell, there's going to be the dictatorship of the proletariat, in which we'll still have political structures, but that will be taken over by the working class. And then he doesn't say a ton. And it's clear that he kind of thinks that political institutions are, I mean, the language he uses is wither, that it's like it's not even going to be this intentional effort to dismantle them, but they're just going to die because we don't need them anymore. Because again, he sort of thought that every social problem that we confront exists because of class struggle. But once we fix those fundamentally economic problems, we're all going to be shiny, happy people.
Right, and that leads to sort of the second problem of when you quote-unquote fix those problems, you get the state up that Marx has called for, and the problem of human nature is still not fixed. Right, then what has to happen? Well, again, I think your options are: assume you were wrong about human nature, or believe that someone is out there thwarting you, and you have to get them. You have to remove them somehow. You have to identify those people and get rid of them. And maybe Marx has a third option. Again, I'm not that familiar with this thought. I don't know what the third option is, but it seems that those are kind of the two choices. And certainly historically, communist states have tended to take that second option.
It's certainly the case that the major experiments in communist government that we've seen have taken that option. But again, I would just say that Marx thought that once we repair our economic relationships, everything's going to be fine, and everybody's just going to arise out of this capitalist fog. And we won't even need states anymore. He certainly calls for revolution. And in some instances, I mean, it's certainly the case that the language that he uses to describe that revolution is, it's revolutionary.
Right. But,
you know, you certainly don't see him celebrating or requiring the need for the gulag and the re-education Yeah. I mean, that's a way in which, I mean, you're certainly right that that's the direction that it's gone in the 20th century. But again, I guess my point is that there's nothing in Marx to sort of make it seem like it necessitated it going that way.
Right, and I'm not familiar enough to know what his suggestions were for such people. If people want to think more about this, two books to read. One of the great conservative classics, which unfortunately is a little bit dated because of his writing style, but Peter Viereck's Shame and Glory of the Intellectuals, I think I probably recommended on here before. It's a book written in the early 1950s, mid-1950s, about how the glory of the intellectuals was their resistance to fascism, and their shame is their utter and complete capitulation to Marxism. Which we'll talk about in just a second. Another book to read, the first dystopian novel, is a book called We, assuming you don't count Plato's Republic, I guess, as a dystopia. A book called We by a guy named Zamyatin. He was writing in the 19-teens, 1920s, I forget which, in the Soviet Union, kind of giving a picture of what life was like moving towards under socialism and whether or not it would work. Anyway, that's sort of the big totalitarian movements of the 20th century that flow out of Marxism. The other, or another, I guess, big influence of Marxism on the 20th century is on the American New Left. So the New Left we've talked about a little bit before on the podcast have their growth spurt in the late 1960s, early 1970s. And really, their intellectual godfather, in some ways, is a man named Herbert Marcuse. Marcuse is an intellectual child of Heidegger, Martin Heidegger, one of Heidegger's students. He was a refugee from Germany, fled to the United States in the 1930s, along with several other philosophers and artists and so on. In the United States, Marcuse and other minor thinkers form the Frankfurt School, which is a wing of a movement called Western Marxism. It has three main goals. This is the school, not just Marcuse. Its first goal is the concern for the creation of quote, reasonable conditions of life. Reasonable has, in that sense, has two meanings. First is reasonable as opposed to religious, so getting rid of religion. The second meaning there is reasonable as opposed to squalid. Our society is to be both rational and prosperous. The second goal of the school is the condemnation of existing conditions as inhuman. The way the world works now is cold and hard and inhuman. We need a society that reflects the true good nature of mankind. And then third, in order to achieve those first two goals, we need total social alteration. Our existing society doesn't have the vehicles within it to be fixable. We need a complete overhaul. For Marcuse, this was more than just simple Marxism. This is a response to totalitarianism that emphasizes freedom and a sort of utopian response to fascism. So it's a utopia that's to be felt more than it's to be described, which means that things like fantasy and imagination are very, very big in Marcuse. Fantasy is necessary to human beings because at our particular time in history, again, in the 50s and 60s, we're conforming to this false suburban standard of living that only kills us slowly instead of setting us free to achieve our full potential as human beings. We need to throw it off in the name of our own humanity. And the means by which we rebel against this 1950s America is imagination and fantasy. Marcuse says that our entire understanding of science is wrong. So again, mid-20th century people think that science is great. It's the means we're going to solve all of our problems. We've just discovered things like penicillin, right? Disease is starting to be eradicated. If we don't have enough food, we'll just engineer better crops and animals. If we have a disease, we'll dedicate money to research a cure. People are sort of embracing technology wholeheartedly. Marcuse says that our entire understanding of science is wrong. He says that we've confused what he calls instrumental reason with teleological reason, and that's the cause of the nightmarish world wars. Again, he's drawing on Heidegger there in criticizing technology and the spiritual effects of us. But he says there's hope where technology is the modern opiate of the masses far more than religion could have ever hoped to be. There's still hope. We can project a new ideal, and finally, in some way, manufacture a good society. And the way we'll bring this about is, as Marx pointed out, the working class has to achieve awareness and rebel for its own freedom. The workers need not just economic relief, but a whole new sensibility and worldview. The problem is the working class just won't do this. Particularly the American working class is far too conservative and stuck in support of the status quo. So they have to be taught and inspired by someone else. And Marcuse thinks that the real leadership of the coming communist revolution are going to be college students. So college students, again, this is the beginning of the radical new left movement, are going to be the backbone of the new communist revolution. Marcuse thinks that he sees beginnings of this in movements like feminism and environmentalism as people start to engage in the pursuit of a more humane world. He never loses hope in the development of a socialist utopia. He argues that the technocratic liberalism that defines so many of us in the Western world can't really provide the answers and the life that we speak, and we have to continually fight against complacency and for this future utopianism that we increasingly have the means to achieve, but not the will to achieve it. And that, again, gets injected into leftist thought in the 60s and 70s, so much so that I think it's sort of unassumed on the part of many leftist thinkers today. This is sort of the groundwork of what many of them are doing, at least as far as I'm familiar with their works. Ed, I've been talking for quite a bit here about Herbert Marcuse. Anything to add?
No, that's a great summary. And, I mean, the interesting thing about Marcuse and the other Frankfurt School thinkers, they're most frequently identified as being neo-Marxist political theorists.
Often self-identified, right?
Yeah. But then I was just going to say that like their intellectual resources are quite a bit broader than that. And so, you know, a lot of what's coming out in the stuff that you're getting, I mean, so there's Heidegger, but there's sort of this deeper kind of critique of modernity,
right?
And
of the way we use it anyway, right? Not of its existence, but of the not just that the modern world exists and things like technology exist, but of the use that technology is put to.
Yeah, but like modernity in that Weberian sense of like this modernity that's driven by a kind of a rationalistic ethos of efficiency and maximization that squeezes the enchantment out of life.
Right.
Like when I think of your kind of traditionalist conservatism, I mean, I kind of think maybe you don't agree with this, but I kind of think that what motivates it at the bottom is a kind of a critique of modernity in that way. So it's just interesting how like it would seem to me that certain aspects of that critique might resonate with you.
Yeah, certainly the criticisms that he makes, particularly of 1950s sort of American dream stuff, I think are right on. So his book, One Dimensional Man. I think if you could somehow only read the criticisms in that book, it would be a fantastic book. It's his solutions that again I think are abhorrent, and carried to their conclusions lead to the gulag and so on. Because again, you have this problem of if people aren't basically good at heart, if removing the shackles of the modern technological world from them does not inspire them to a life of virtue and goodness, what's the next step then? It doesn't seem that the next step is to say, well, gosh, maybe I was wrong. Maybe I shouldn't have done that. I think the next step is to punish the people who are still soiling your society.
Well, so I don't know Marcuse's thought very well at all, but I'd be shocked if there are elements in it that is recommending like the embrace of violence and re-education in it.
Yeah, so he has you get into that a little bit in his definition of toleration. Which is increasingly sort of adopted again by the left. This idea that toleration isn't really you let everyone have their say, and if they say something you don't like, toleration is you allow that. Rather, it's toleration is we impose our view on others because it's actually better for them. Right? We shout down speakers we don't like because they're saying evil things. Toleration should never be a toleration of evil. So there is, now he doesn't call for, you know, throwing rocks at people or anything like that, but it's not a large step from what he says to sort of throwing rocks at people and so on.
Where did you write about toleration?
In his essay on toleration.
Oh.
I can get the name of it.
No, that's fine. I can find that.
Repressive Tolerance is the name of his essay.
Uh-huh. And that's an essay. Not a book.
Possibly a chapter in a book.
Uh-huh. I'll have to look at that.
Yeah, I think it's an essay.
Anyways, you know, one of the interesting things that comes out of that is you're rooting all of this in a kind of this utopianism that sees human beings as being essentially good.
Yes, those are two fundamental components of Marxism. If you remove those, you're not talking about Marxism anymore.
Okay. I just mentioned that. I mean, so no Christian can think that, obviously.
Right. Yeah, I think there's an inherent disconnect, sort of a fundamental disagreement between communism and Christianity, even as there are, you know, points of overlap in the details, right? The idea of community
Then I was just going to say that, like, there can be significant disagreements as the way in which we think about, like, actually, I take that back. I mean, there is a way in which, in fact, I mean, I think you actually have to think that human beings have this intrinsic kind of dignity and value. That's fundamental. The problem is that we are fallen.
Right.
And then we can have some hard debates about what the most apt way is to describe our situation, you know, which get at some of the most fundamental disagreements in theology about, like, I'm not particularly reformed in my theology, but in just the idea of common grace and how robust a theology of common grace we're going to have over and against, you know, that other side of Reformed theology that's sort of going to emphasize total depravity.
Right, but if your view of common grace is such that you have negated original sin...
Oh, sure.
You've gone too far.
Sure.
And again, there's... Christians must have both the idea of man as created in the image of God and the idea of original sin. You have to have both of those things. Communists don't. Just as I mean, I don't. Nothing is springing to mind of people who believe of a movement that believes that man is always bad all the time. But if there were such a movement, then that would also be anathema to Christians.
Yeah, I guess just sometimes, just because human beings are fallen doesn't mean that. This comes up occasionally. Doesn't mean that all social problems are rooted in original sin so fundamentally that nothing can be done to improve our social circumstances.
Right.
And I would certainly want to push back against that idea. Yeah, so we're fallen and we're sinful, but that doesn't mean that certain kinds of social arrangements aren't better than others. And certain kinds of social arrangements actually sort of exacerbate our fallenness in ways that...
Certainly, anyway. Slavery, right, would be a great example of that.
Yeah, I'm down on slavery. How about you, Coyle?
I'm also down on slavery.
Okay, good.
You wanted to talk a little bit about the criticisms that communism makes of the modern world, particularly of employment and technology and such. So why don't you tell us what communism gets right in the 21st century?
Yeah, so it's interesting. You know, in the 20th century, we have the rise of the great communist states, especially the Soviet Union, and we have the Cold War. And before a big chunk of the 20th century, we have this grand competition between, you know, these two political ideologies. And then the Berlin Wall falls. You get the collapse of all of the Soviet bloc states. You have the democratic revolution in Tiananmen Square in 1989.
Which does not end well.
Which does not end well. But in any case, there's this huge political revolution such that a lot of Western thinkers were proclaiming the end of history. And there was a way in which democratic capitalism was vindicated over and against all competing ideologies. And there's a way in which I think Marxist political thought certainly fell out of favor from the late 80s, just because the political project collapsed. In addition to all of the horrors of the Cultural Revolution and Stalin and the killing fields in Cambodia, etc. But then I think in the wake of the Great Recession happens in 2007. And sort of since then, there's been this really interesting revival of neo-Marxist economic thought to try to make sense of the contemporary economy and its particular pathologies. You know, a lot of this happens in the wake of the Great Recession, and the first place I remember seeing it was in an article by Paul Krugman, the Princeton economist and New York Times columnist. And he wrote an article called The Rise of the Machines, or The Rise of the Robots, I think it was. It was just one of his Times op-eds. And he was sort of talking, and so at this point, I can't remember the year it came out, but the Great Recession had ended, the stimulus bill had been passed, officially the recession had ended, and we had tipped back into economic growth. But there was a way in which the economy was growing, and a lot of big companies, especially financial firms, were starting to make a lot of money again. And so the economy was growing at a relatively moderate rate, and things looked good. But unemployment was still stuck at a high number. And so there was this weird disconnect in the way in which the economy was growing, but unemployment wasn't coming down. And not only was unemployment not coming down, there were worries about wage stagnation and growing attention to the problem of inequality.
Which was sort of the inverse of how the Great Recession started, right? Back in the early 2000s when you had these companies losing money left and right, but unemployment was still low, workers' wages were going up. I mean,
interest rates were still low. Companies were making tons and tons of money until they weren't, right? So it was only when the bubble popped, but things looked fine up until then. But in any case, and so, there was all of this question of, well, this is weird. What's going on here? Where is this inequality coming from? Why are wages stagnating? Why is unemployment remaining so high, even though the economy is growing? And a lot of people started to point to the phenomenon of the role that advanced technology was playing in economic production. And so one of the things that's going on is that with the rise of advanced robotics, with the rise of ever more sophisticated computing, now increasingly with the rise of artificial intelligence, you're getting the possibility that computers and advanced robotics can replace an ever increasing number of jobs that human beings used to do. So, one interesting thing, for example, about our current situation is like with regard to people talk about the death of American manufacturing, which isn't true at all. Like the United States, whether you're measuring by wealth or even by like the number of unit of stuff produced, the United States is manufacturing more than it ever has in the history of the United States. We're producing tons of stuff. But the deal is because of advances in technology, we can produce this stuff with a fraction of the labor that we used to produce. So, here's just an example. I have a friend who recently started a company. They're manufacturing stuff. And when they first started out, they were contracting with a manufacturing plant in China to produce the stuff that they were producing. And it took 100 people. And they were doing sort of very crude manufacturing in China and took 100 people to produce a certain unit of the stuff that they are producing.
Early model iPods.
Yes, yeah, something like that. No, less sophisticated than that.
100 children, yes.
I believe that children weren't physically strong enough to do the kind of work that they were doing. But anyways, but then they opened up a couple places in the United States and it wasn't even they're not doing high-end stuff. It wasn't even they had advanced robotics. But basically, they were able to produce the same number of units at the Chinese factory. I think they have something 12 full-time employees. And then they'll occasionally bring on part-time employees. But basically, they can produce the same number with 12 people as was produced in China with 100. And so they brought manufacturing back to the United States because it was cheaper for them. even though labor costs in China are cheaper than they are in the United States, we're manufacturing with 1/10 the number of people, which is kind of amazing. And that's just the story of manufacturing in the United States. We're producing tons and tons of stuff. Manufacturing is actually coming back to the United States in lots of ways. But the reason it's coming back is because it's now cheaper for us to produce with machines than it is to produce with foreign labor. So we're getting all of this economic growth, but it's not resulting in jobs for human beings. And then, of course, the worry is that, so this is a familiar story with manufacturing. I mean, we've seen this story since the 70s when we first started to lose manufacturing jobs to Asia. But then the worry is now we're starting to make the next technological advance. And so now we're no longer talking about sophisticated machines and industrial equipment, but sophisticated computers who can start to do the same jobs that human beings and human beings alone used to be able to do. So now we're starting to see the erosion, not just of blue collar working class jobs, but now like white collar administrative jobs.
Or still blue collar like service jobs. So like you go to McDonald's, you don't have to order at the register anymore. Yep. Yep. There's now a machine there you can punch your order into.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So even those jobs are going away.
Certainly. At a greater rate. And occasionally you'll read an article about some new test McDonald's in which the burgers are made by machines. And I was at a hotel in LA and I checked in and I was waiting to go to the hotel. And there was this robot that pulled up next to me, and it was kind of like an R2-D2. And it was mainly for show, but like they had this robot that would go from the front desk up to somebody's room and knock to perform very simple tasks. I was kind of freaked out.
Ed, you have a moral responsibility to open fire on that robot.
Anyways, because that's somebody's job.
No, because it's a robot knocking on your door.
Anyways, so you see this trend, and Marx is very interested in this trend, and it gets at something that animated Marx in the mid-19th century. Because even though technological change is happening at an ever-increasing rate, obviously, industrialization wouldn't have happened without important technological advances. And it is like an essential feature of capitalism from the beginning that the bourgeois factory owner takes part of his profit, reinvests in new technology so that he can cut labor costs and produce the same product for less and less money and make the same profit. And that, that's an essential part of capitalism. And it's an essential part of capitalism, and it also plays this really important role in encouraging the ultimate revolution. Because what happens is you have larger and larger number of unemployed workers who are competing for fewer and fewer jobs as this technological revolution happens. And then because you have a growing number of unemployed workers competing for fewer jobs, wages fall. So you have a growing number of workers competing for fewer and fewer bad jobs. And that's really important because that ultimately is what engenders a sufficient level of immiseration of the proletariat to actually want to overthrow the bourgeois state. Oh, and then in addition to that, as I mentioned earlier, as we talked about earlier, Marx doesn't say a ton about what future communist society is going to look like. But he says some interesting suggestive things about the way in which that future communist state, in which we're going to work some, but we're also going to hunt and fish and write poetry and spend time associating with each other. It's really clear that that sort of future communist utopian society is only going to be possible because we have these advanced technologies that are going to do all the work for us. So we're not going to need to spend all of the time that we used to spend. So like on Marx's analysis, technology plays this really important dual role. It hastens the immiseration of the proletariat to make possible and to encourage the revolution, the communist revolution. But then equally, communist utopian society is only going to be possible when we have achieved this certain level of technological advance.
Right. Now, a lot of what you said a capitalist wouldn't disagree with, right? They would agree with you about the growth of technology and the elimination of jobs and so on. Their response or what they would say is, yeah, all of that happens, and the result is not a communist revolution, but rather developments of new markets, right? The creation of new jobs, other places, the expansion of the market economy in different directions where it had not gone before.
I guess that's right. So, I mean, classically, free market economics, I think, doesn't spend a lot of time thinking about the rise of this ever-growing unemployment class. But it's true, the story that you get is that these advances in technology actually end up creating more jobs rather than fewer. And so, lots of people like to point to the advent of the ATM. And so a lot of people worried that the creation of the ATM would eliminate all of these teller jobs. But what ended up happening actually was that it lowered the cost of opening up a bank branch, and so it made banking cheaper. And because banking got cheaper, it made it possible to expand banking. And so the story is that even though it eliminated teller jobs, it ended up actually creating more jobs, the kinds of jobs that human beings uniquely can do. And so there were fewer tellers, but more banking jobs because there were more banking outlets, and there are certain kinds of things that human beings and human beings alone can do. The big debate now, though, is that with the advent of artificial intelligence technology, that sphere of things that human beings can uniquely do basically is becoming extraordinarily narrow. And so it's certainly the case that you can look at the rise of these new technologies and point to the way in which, in a number of really prominent cases, it's led to reduced costs, increased demand, and expansion of services. But, I mean, that obviously engenders displacement, for one thing. There's a little bit of a question as to the extent to which, this can continue unabated going into the future with the rise of artificial intelligence.
Well, right. Both of those worldviews make assumptions about human nature. So the communist assumes that people are good and it'll sort of all work out as the technology develops. The capitalist assumes that people are hardworking and industrious and are going to go out and make their new opportunities, right? Make new things happen. And if you reject both of those assumptions, it leaves you in kind of a difficult spot, which I think largely at this point. I don't know that Americans have the 19th century spirit of entrepreneurship that we used to have. I might be wrong. I hope I am, but I don't think so.
I mean, how can you say that? Like, the economy is more dynamic than it's ever been. And the possibility for, the possibility of people to create new businesses and new ways of doing things is greater than it's ever been.
The possibility certainly is, but I think American whininess and self-entitlement is also greater than it's ever been. So I think that's offset by the decline of American character.
Yeah.
So the possibility is there, but you have to be willing to go out and work to do it.
And so do you think entrepreneurship is down?
I think it... Yeah, I don't know. So I don't know numbers, but it seems that the number of people who are willing to go out and say do manual labor as a place to begin, mm-hmm. that's certainly down, right? One good example. There are ever more farms available for anyone who wants to go out and work on them. They're to the point where you could have your own farm tomorrow if you wanted it at a fairly reasonable rate. And people just aren't willing to do that, even though cattle and grain prices are now up and you really could make a living at it if you're willing to do the labor. So mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what that looks like in the tech sector. I assume that entrepreneurship is up some places, but across the board, I don't know for sure. My instinct says it's down.
Yeah. I mean, so all of which is to say that, the economy that we live in now is a really new and different kind of a thing. And there is a lot of debate and hand-wringing over the extent to which capitalism necessarily engenders. And so this is just where the revival of neo-Marxist economic thought comes into the picture. But whether capitalism just is going to engender growing unemployment, stagnating wages, and greater inequality. You know, the other sort of big moment in neo-economic, Marxist economic thought was the publication of Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century. That came out in 2013. And, you know, I don't know that he's, like, formally neo-Marxist, but of course the big point of that book was that there was just something essential about the nature of capitalism. So that is, like, a very comprehensive empirical study of inequality in the 20th century and just the extent to which capitalism necessarily generates inequality and what we're going to do about it. But it's interesting the way in which the nature of the contemporary economy is bringing people to draw back on Marxist ideas to try to make sense of it. And so one public policy idea that has been that a lot of people are interested in. It's not exactly neo-Marxist, but it's certainly an idea that's in that comfortably fits in that family, is just the idea of universal basic income. The idea that what the state, and you know, one interesting thing about that idea is that that idea is very popular amongst a certain kind of libertarian economist, as well as a certain kind of progressive, politically progressive person. And right, and so the idea there is that instead of creating these social welfare programs to help people float through economic disenfranchisement, we just need to sort of guarantee some basic income. And so every month, everybody would, regardless of economic status, would just get a check in the mail. And people could use that money however they want. They could work less, or they could take that money and use it to invest in business opportunities. There have been a number of really, really interesting studies of the effects of universal basic, like these UBI experiments that have been done in a number of different places. And the results that they've had, that these experiments have had, have been really, really striking. I mean, the big criticism, obviously, is that people are just going to stop working. And it's true that the number of hours per week that people choose to work declines slightly, but it only declines slightly. And then what's interesting is how people choose to use that increased leisure time. And so a lot of people are just spending more time with children at home. Some people are using that to retrain and increase their skills. And then in a host of other indicators, there's this one study that was done in Canada, I think, and like there were these astonishing side benefits that arose out of it. Like there was a decrease in the number of emergency room visits and an increase in, well, let me put the point this way, and a decrease in the number of days of school that were missed amongst children, and all these other weird, a decrease in people's reliance on unemployment benefits and the like. Anyways, so, you know, we find ourselves in this moment in which there's a lot of hand-wringing about the nature of the modern economy. I mean, that's what brought Trump into power, right? A similar kind of story about the loss, the effect of globalization and the loss of these blue-collar jobs. And now what are we going to do about that?
Though not a desire for communist policies in its place.
Well,
it's
just interesting to me that in some ways there was this, the death of Marxist thought in the late 80s, early 90s, and then this interesting revival of Marxist economic thought to try to make sense of certain kinds of trends that appear to be characteristic of our modern economy. And there's a way in which, like, Marx might yet be vindicated. And there are lots of reasons to think that those big communist projects in the Soviet Union and China were just never going to work. Because again, in Marxist thought, it's really clear that a certain level of technological development needs to have happened. And it's clear that that level of technological achievement hadn't happened in the Soviet Union or China. Like, you need it to kick off the revolution, but then equally we need it for communist society, this utopian society, to work. And I can't remember if I said this last time. So there's a way in which, like, if you wanted to be a really good Marxist, what you should do is you should try to be Elon Musk. You know, you should try to be this capitalist technologist to both hasten the coming communist revolution and also to create the technology that's necessary to make it possible.
Right. Know your stage in history and sort of
exactly
push that stage to its fullest.
Yeah, exactly. But do you have thoughts on any of that stuff, on technological employment or UBI?
So, yeah, I'm always going to be a little bit suspicious of the claim that that thing that led to totalitarianism in other countries, we should do that here. Even if it's followed up with the, but we'll do it better. Like, that's just not going to be much of a selling point with me. And I suspect one of the reasons that we're seeing a comeback of Marxist studies is because Americans have no sense of historical awareness. And there's just no idea that, hey, maybe this has been tried before and it didn't end well, so maybe we shouldn't try it again. I mean, which isn't a solution, which isn't a proposed solution to technological unemployment. I mean, that's not saying. And I'm not an economist or an industrialist or an entrepreneur, so I'm probably not the person to ask for a solution to either of those things. Same thing with the universal basic income. It sort of sounds like raising the minimum wage, which. The tiny rudimentary understanding of economics that I think I have says that's a terrible idea too. Yeah, you're just going to eliminate more jobs. We'll see even fewer people working at McDonald's. But again, I'm not an economist there. I'll defer to people who know more about that than I do. Yeah. So my response is don't think we're smarter or better than the Soviets were, particularly when we're using the same ideas.
Well, I guess that whole point was in some ways that it's not the same ideas, right? That, like, there's just this the evolution and development of technology is just plays a huge role in this. And so for me, like, the idea that our current economic forms are just the last kind of – that, in fact, there is an end of history and there is this vindication of liberal democratic capitalism – like, I just don't know about that. Like, I believe in liberal capitalist political and economic institutions. I'm not a socialist. I'm a social democrat, I guess. I sort of believe in capitalist political institutions tempered by a pretty robust welfare state. But, like, it's really, I mean, we're in this really interesting period in which there's a lot of uncertainty about whether the wage problem or the unemployment problem are just sort of bumps in the road or are ever increasing irremedial features of the contemporary economy. So what are we going to do? You know, what are we going to do if unemployment just keeps creeping up and inequality keeps creeping up and the wage gap continues to fall? Like, just what are we going to do? Is that just, are we just going to be like, well, we live in a fallen world. We have 25% unemployment and people are eating dog food, but there's nothing better to be done.
Right.
I mean,
I suppose it depends on the causes of that.
Right? Well, that's exactly the question. Like, what is the effect of these advanced technologies? You know, you and I are in a good position because while finding academic jobs, I mean, every student who I meet with who's interested in going to grad school, my first move is you really should not do that. You should think about doing something else. Because obviously academia is not what we would call a growth industry these days. But at the same time, like, these kinds of jobs are going to be the last jobs to be automated. Just because they're the kind of job that's just going to be hardest to get computers to do. Like, there are projects out there in which they're trying to figure out how to get computers to grade papers. But, like, that's really, really hard.
I mean, computers write papers, so it makes sense that, like, you could have some formula for grading them too.
Yeah,
I
mean,
I have students who use computer generated papers. Not many.
Buying a paper online is different than a computer generated paper.
Well, yeah, I mean that is a different thing, but there are computer generated papers too.
Are there really?
There are. It's really disturbing.
Well, but there's no way those papers are any good.
No, and fortunately, the students that tend to try to get away with those are usually the students that I don't believe they wrote the paper in the first place. And, of course, we have pretty sophisticated software for catching them. So.
Yeah, but all those papers have been written by human beings, and they're just being bought and resold online.
Although those are the ones that are bought online. There are paper generators, too.
Yeah. But, you know, but if you engage in any kind of data analysis, like, you know, you have some well-paid data analysis job right now. Like, your job is not long for this world, because there's a computer that can not only replace you, it can do a better job than you, you know? Right. And so the only jobs that are left are going to be the kinds of jobs that are, like, just really highly creative jobs.
Or manual labor. We're always going to be plumbers or electricians or, like... I encourage my students who want to go to law. So I'm the pre-law advisor at SBU.
Yeah.
I encourage my students who want to go to law school to go out and learn how to be a plumber first, and then, or, you know, electrician or carpenter or whatever, and then go to law school in the evenings once you're established and pay for it with your income from your much better paying job than you'll ever have as an attorney anyway.
I don't know about that, but I mean, plumbers make a lot of money, but like...
They make more money than I'll ever make. I mean, I'm not an attorney, but...
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on where you're applying your trade. But in any case, yeah, I mean, those kinds of skilled manual labor jobs are also going to be hard to replace. But, you know, eventually there's going to be a robot that does that.
And now we're back to open fire when it knocks on your door.
Well, that's right. The robot's going to knock on your door, and you're either going to shoot him, or he's going to come in and he's going to fix your toilet.
It'll be the last door it ever knocks on.
Or it might be the last door you'll ever open. Because, frankly, Coyle, if I had to choose between you and a robot, I know where I'm putting my money.
That's fair. That's the good social bet there.
Yeah, you know, there are movies about this kind of thing, and it usually ends bad for the humans.
That's true. Well, Ed, anything else on communism? I don't know that I have anything to add. Here's where we probably should have got a good intellectual historian on the show to talk about this a little more, just because that's really neither of our wheelhouse.
Well, I think the next 10 to 20 years are going to be really interesting. And it's either going to be the case that Marx is totally vindicated, or we're living in some kind of absurd dystopian society in which you and I are living out on the streets trying to dispense philosophical wisdom while, you know, androids are walking around fixing our toilets.
Yeah, I was saying maybe we'll be in toilets.
I mean, the happy, soft lane, I mean, the thing to hope for is, I mean, I don't know, maybe, you know, maybe Marx is right, and that's like a really great thing. And not that there's going to be this devolution to like the stateless society, but eventually we'll be able to produce so much of the stuff that we need using machines, and we figure out political structures that are going to distribute wealth in a fair way, and then we'll all just work less. I mean, we'll still work, because I think work has value. But I think it's the soft landing to hope for is a world in which we're all doing work for something like 30 hours a week and have the resources to live minimally decent lives.
So there are no farmers in this world.
Farming is interesting because even now, I mean, you know a lot more about this than I do, but like even now it's, you have these single farmers who are farming like all of this acreage using their GPS-connected, Wi-Fi-enabled, air-conditioned tractors, and they're just kind of sitting there while the tractor does all the work. I mean, like, how many... I mean, I guess it depends on the kind of farming that you're doing. But even now, like, if I have a big corn farm, how many people do I need to work
in? Oh, yeah, it totally depends on the kind of agriculture and where you are. But it's still...
Because you can harvest corn mechanically, right?
You can, but you still... It's still more than 30 hours a week. I mean...
Oh, yeah, okay. But, you know, I mean, a lot of agriculture has already gone the way of just, I mean, and that happened a long time ago.
And
right?
that was sort of a result of there not being enough farmers, so the technology had to step in, because I think the average age of the American farmer now is like 60. I mean, people are doing what I did and growing up in an agricultural setting and then leaving and not going back because it's mm-hmm. brutal back-breaking labor that doesn't pay that much. And mm-hmm. it's not because there's not a need for it. It's because people just don't want to do it. So the mm-hmm. machines sort of have to take over, although they're only of limited use. You still have to have the human element there. But anyway,
I didn't even know what a big, like, what's a medium-sized farm?
It depends on where you are. So like a family farm where I grew up would be a few thousand acres.
A few thousand acres?
Yeah, it's all dry land. Like, it doesn't get enough moisture, cattle ranches and so on. But in where I live now, you know, a family farm is a few hundred acres. It just uh-huh. depends on where you are.
And could I farm a few hundred acres of soybean by myself, basically?
Yes, I know less about soybeans, but you could. You and your family, right? Not just you personally.
Yeah. So, you know, yeah, that technological revolution happened a long time ago in some way.
A few years back. It's been within the last 15, because it's been since I've been there. We did not have GPS tractors when I was living on the ranch.
Yeah, okay. But those things are ubiquitous now. And pretty soon, you know, all of that's automated. I mean, there'll be advances. But pretty soon, like, any kind of driving job, whether we're talking about taxis or trucking, like, that's going to be all done by driverless car. I think you and I are both going to be in driverless cars in 10 years. Like, that's going to be ubiquitous. And if not 5 years, and there's going to be no more data analyst jobs. There's certainly going to be no more call centers. Like, all our calls are going to be handled by computers, but it's not going to be, like, totally frustrating. It's going to be better than a human experience, probably. And
you're much more technologically optimistic than I am, but...
Well, that isn't necessarily... I mean, it depends on what you mean by optimistic. I mean, like, I think that's going to just... Well, in the sense that I think it's definitely going to happen in the extremely near future. Whether or not it's a good thing or a bad thing is very much an open question to me. But we live in interesting times, you and I.
That's certainly true. Thank you again for listening to the City of Man podcast. For more information about our podcast or any of the other shows on the Christian Humanist Network, please visit christianhumanist.org or leave us a review on iTunes so that other people can find us as well. You can check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. Leave us messages there or contact us directly at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. On behalf of Ed Sung, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's and render unto God those things that are God's.
Das Vidanya, Comrade Neil.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. I went a walk in that ribbon of highway.